Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1357, Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 31. This is being recorded on November 9th of the year 2024. This is the 20th anniversary of Iris Chang's murder, if she was murdered. And perhaps Monty said, even in this or one of the following programs, we can ruminate about Iris Chang's, and again, she, quote, murder. I mean, she didn't, quote, commit suicide, unquote. But she was doing both a book project and a documentary film project about the survivors of the Bataan Death March, who were very much on the front burner, so to speak, because of lawsuits, because many of them were also used as slave laborers by the Japanese. And in so doing, Iris Chang was cutting across some of the deep politics you've been unpacking for us with Tsuji Masanobu, the guy I grimly call the celebrity chef of the Bataan Death March. He killed and cannibalized some of the Bataan Death Marches, I suspect, but some of the survivors might very well have some memories of that, because that would certainly, amidst even all the other horrors that they endured, that would be beyond belief. I mean, there's no way that they would forget that. And of course, he went to work for U.S. intelligence. And then you've got Seizo Arisu and Masanobu, the liaison between the fledgling CIA and Chiang Kai-shek's Kuomintang. It's just, rest in peace, Iris Chang. You know, again, the 20th anniversary of her murder today, and the deep political forces that she was exposing and confronting are very much with us today. And in the pivot to Asia and the things you've been unpacking for us, Monty, and the things you're going to be unpacking in weeks to come, I think in one sense, I wouldn't call it the fulfillment because that's the wrong word, but it certainly is a manifestation of the will to express and expose those things to the daylight. And also in that same context, we will be talking in these shows, plural, about Trump's election, what that means, the implications for people. And by the way, we're going to pivot to COVID for a long time. That might seem, you know, where goes Dave again? How come Dave and Monty talk about COVID? With Brainworm Bobby apparently going to be wielding a disproportionate influence on public health policy, I think we really need to evaluate that because there has been a huge perpetuation of deadly COVID misinformation. And this comes from medical authorities and other things, and we're going to talk about that. But I reiterate something I've said in past programs. I don't think that we are going to make it as a civilization. I mean, I'd like to be optimistic, but to do so, I'd have to do something that I really have always refrained from, that is lying to the audience. I don't want to lie to you. I don't want to overwhelm you, but hell, reality is going to overwhelm you. Oh boy, is it going to overwhelm you. And I think, again, as sentient beings, we have a responsibility at the very least to preserve the historical record, preserve a record of what the hell happened. And that way, when your grandchildren, if you're lucky enough to have them and if they're lucky enough to survive, when they're asking, you know, gee, Mom or gee, Dad, how come we're living in a rusted out Chevy sport van? I don't even remember what those were. Just you told me that was what this used to be. And how come when we want something to eat, we have to go out and we have to fight with former Army Rangers over rat-killing turf? I mean, people didn't always live like this. I know I've seen pictures on the Internet, you know, when we can access it, and we don't have any connection here at home. And, you know, they used to have these phones that could access it. But what happened, Dad? What happened, Mom? And you can crank up your generator or whatever and hook up your phone, your computer maybe. And you can show them from the flash drive what happened. But again, I think we have an obligation as sentient beings to preserve the record. And I get no money whatsoever from this, neither does Marpy. If the latest flash drive We'll probably be through, programs at the end of this calendar year, maybe even the early 2025. If, by the way, you have problems, with the tech involved with the flash drive, please do contact the station. I don't have the technical capabilities to deal with that and let alone make the flash drives, but please do that. The newest flash drive will not only have all of my work on COVID, but also all of the conversations with Monty to date and probably going for another month or two or three. So please do get that. There's a link at the top of the description, the program descriptions that will enable you to do that. Again, neither myself nor Monty gets any money from this. Monty, you have a couple of quotes from the late Dr. Martin Luther King that I think are excellent in characterizing the existential, philosophical, and political juncture at which we find ourselves. And I wonder if you would be kind enough to relate those to us.
Absolutely, Dave. And I just want to say it is once again a pleasure and a privilege to be on your program. The first quote I'd like to share from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Is as follows, quote, "The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of convenience and comfort, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy," end quote.
Amen.
And I believe that, absolutely, amen. And I believe that encapsulates the spirit of all of those who are still up until the moment of Armageddon, whatever moment that may be in the future, where we all realize that death is the great equalizer and that we are all brothers and sisters on this little blue dot in space. For those that are still fighting for the truth up until that moment, I think it encapsulates that spirit. And there's a second quote on Dr. King that I'd like to share. And I believe this encapsulated how I felt about Mr. Trump reaching the chief executive not once but twice, and how alone I felt as not only a combat veteran, but as a citizen of the United States of America. And I just would like to quote Dr. King once again, and the quote goes, quote, "He who passively accepts evil is as much involved in it as he who helps to perpetuate it. He who accepts evil without protesting against it is really cooperating with it," end quote.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, who was Ella Wheeler Wilcox? I had never heard of her until I saw a quote from her in the opening credits to the movie JFK. Do you know who she was offhand?
Unfortunately, offhand, I do not know.
She said, and I will upgrade it to a non-gender specific reference, but she said, "To sin by silence when we should protest makes cowards of people."
Absolutely.
Yep, and Dr. King also observed it, perhaps in that same vein, "In the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends." Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. You know, we're going to read, Monty and I are going to switch off, reading from an article from Counterpunch magazine from November 1st of 2024 called "Nuremberg on the Hudson." And that was a discussion of Donald Trump's Madison Square Garden rally and what I call barstool fascism. But, you know, people should remember, Monty, you have unpacked for us information about the domestic Gladio in the 544 right. Camp Street, 531 Lafayette Place, intelligence front run by Guy Bannister and obviously heavily involved in the JFK assassination, was also an area of intersection between the intelligence community and the various fascist groups that comprise the domestic Gladio. And people have attempted to excuse what happened on January 6th of 2021, as well as, you know, a bunch of government agents. I don't doubt that there were a bunch of them in there, but it was far more than that. And in a recent book called Gangsters of Capitalism, subtitled Smedley Butler, the Marines, and the Making and Breaking of America's Empire by Jonathan M. Katz, and it's published in hardcover by St. Martin's Press, it talks about the 34 coup attempt. It talks about Smedley Butler's operations in Haiti, in Nicaragua, and the things that he spoke about when he described himself as, quote, a high-priced gangster for capitalism. That's where the title of the book comes from. But it was also Smedley Butler who busted, literally, the 1934 coup attempt by the same fascist financiers and industrialists who had financed Hitler and Mussolini and also the Japanese. And when they wanted to do the same thing here in 1934, they tapped Smedley Butler to lead the coup, and he pretended to go along, and he busted them.
Specifically, real quick, the man that tapped Smedley Butler, his name was Gerald McGuire, and he represented an entity called the Guarantee Trust Company, which was not only used as a front for Nazi Germany's financing of their, well, let's just say the bribing of government officials in this country. That's what it was used for. But the Guarantee Trust Company later became a conduit for the CIA in order to induce defectors from the Soviet Union. So talk about continuity of interest right there.
Well, there is. The deep politics are really important.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Near the end of the book, specifically on pages 328 and 329, Jonathan Katz contacted Smedley Butler's granddaughter, a woman named Philippa, capital P-H-I-L-I-P-P-A, Raley, capital W-E-H-L-E, I may be mispronouncing that. But he asked her about her reflections on the coup attempt, which is what it was on January 6th. And Smedley Butler, and her reflections on that, and I'm going to read that here.
Mm-hmm.
A few weeks after the siege, I talked to Smedley Butler's 85-year-old granddaughter, Philippa Raley. I asked her over Skype what her grandfather would have thought of the events of January 6th. Her hazel eyes narrowed as she pondered, quote, I think he would have been in there. He would have been in the fray somehow, unquote. For an unsettling moment, I was unsure what she meant. Butler had much in common with both sides of the siege. Like Trump's mob, he had often doubted the validity of democracy when practiced by non-whites. The most prominent Trumpist conspiracy theories about purported fraud in the 2020 election centered on cities with large immigrant and black populations. Like many of the Putschists, Butler saw himself as a warrior for the, quote, little guy, unquote, against a vast constellation of elite interests, even though he also, like most of the capital attackers, was relatively well off. Moreover, the greatest proportion of veterans arrested in connection with the attempted putsch were Marines. An active-duty Marine major, a field artillery officer at Quantico, was caught on video pushing open the doors to the East Rotunda and accused by federal prosecutors of allowing other rioters to stream in. Again, a field artillery officer, an active-duty Marine major. Think about the domestic Gladio things we have spoken about. Continuing. But I knew, too, that Butler had taken his stand for democracy and against the business plot. I would like to think he would have seen through Trump as well. Butler had rejected Father Coughlin's pro-Trumpian brand of red-beating, anti-Semitic conspiratorial populism, going so far as to inform FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover of an alleged 1936 effort involving the reactionary priest, to overthrow the left-leaning government of Mexico. And Marty, we've spoken, you've unpacked for us William Rhodes Davis and the genesis and the of Los Pecos, funded by William Rhodes Davis. And so when he talks about that, that goes directly into some of the deep politics that you've been kind enough and, you know, in this terrible time, heroic enough to present to us. Continuing. When the reporter for the Marxist magazine New Masses asked Butler, quote, just where he stood politically, unquote, in the wake of the business plot, he name-checked several of the most left-leaning members of Congress and said the only group he would give his, quote, blanket approval to, unquote, was the American Federation of Labor. Butler added that he would not only, quote, die to preserve democracy, unquote, but also, crucially, quote, fight to broaden it, unquote. Perhaps it would have come down to timing. At what point in his life the attack on the government might have taken place? Quote, do you think he would have been in with the people storming the Capitol, unquote? I asked Philippa tentatively. This time she answered immediately, quote, no, heavens no. He would have been trying to do something about it, unquote. He might have been killed, she added, given that the police were so unprepared. Were they really? I would add, or was this domestic radio? Continuing, which is so disturbing because, of course, they should have known. They would have known. They only had to read the papers, unquote. Man, Marty, I tell you, it just, Reman brings tears to my eyes. You know, it is so accurate. And I think Jonathan Katz has very appropriately characterized those events and where we stand. Because now the guy who led that is now president of the United States. This is a guy whose lawyers argued before a federal appellate court that he should be allowed to kill people, order the military to kill political rivals, and that he would have immunity from prosecution if he did it as a seated president. This is a guy, and we'll talk about COVID later on in these programs. This is a guy who got up at a press conference about COVID, and said basically, if you get infected, just drink a little disinfectant. You know, I mean, my God, you know, a 5-year-old knows better than that. Certainly an 8-year-old, but I mean, that is surreal. But now he is president of the United States. You know, Monty, we're gonna talk about what I call barstool fascism, because I think that's in a sense what we have here. The people who went for him, yeah, I mean,
ultimately, it's the name of the game. It's the name of the game. You know, we officially have gone from a democratic republic to a fascist autocracy through a vote. That is what has happened.
And as we've spoke about in our last programs, that's what Hitler did too. And we'll get to see just what Trump is going to do. But, you know, in keeping with the Jonathan Katz quote and how he ruminated about how Smedley Butler had some things in common with the people who were storming the Capitol on January 6, 2021. And, he shared some of their grievances, and yet he also saw through the whole thing and how they were being, how, people like that could be manipulated. And by the way, he also, spoke to and on behalf of and in sympathy with the bonus marchers who were World War I veterans who were promised a bonus for signing up and going to combat, for going to war. And they did, and they never got their bonus. And so when the Depression hit, they camped out in Washington saying, where were their bonuses? And the guy
actually, if I may clarify there, the bonuses were only, it's not that they did not receive their bonuses, it's that the Depression happened and they needed their bonuses. You see, the bonuses were only to be paid out in May of 1945. So.
Oh, okay. So they wanted, what they wanted was early payment.
That's right, because the bonuses were only supposed to be paid in May of 1945. Interesting date, May 1945. That's when the World War I veterans were to receive their bonuses.
Yeah, well, they did. They got the end of World War II, and they did their bonuses. I mean, it just, you know, some of them wound up, you know, how about the bonuses for the Bataan Death March? How about Iris Chang's bonus? I mean, my God.
It's right, just, right.
It's surreal, but, you know, there have been characterizations of those who support Trump. And Hillary Clinton, I think, expressed vindictiveness that lacked understanding and perhaps compassion, which she characterized them as deplorables. And then Biden kind of doubled down in 2024 when he referred to them as, quote, garbage, unquote. Again, vindictive, but lacking in understanding, certainly, and perhaps a measure of compassion to be arrived at through understanding. That's not to say complicity. That's not to say you don't oppose it, but you need to understand it. And I think, as I have thought about the Trump supporters, a quote from Dr. Johnson centuries ago comes to mind, and I think it shows certainly understanding and perhaps, maybe I'm reading too much, but perhaps a degree of compassion as well. And yet, he understood the importance of standing up to it. And Dr. Johnson observed, quote, and this, I think, characterizes those who support Trump, quote, those who make beasts of themselves escape the pain of being human.
Well, you said it all there.
Yep, and it is. I mean, certainly, you know, we've spoken, the average person is getting screwed, but they don't know who's doing the screwing. And we've gotten to a point now where, you know, Haitian immigrants who are supposedly eating people's pets in Springfield, Ohio, despite the fact that the Republican governor of the city said, no, that's not happening. The Republican governor of the state of Ohio, Mike DeWine, had a full-page editorial in the New York Times saying, Sunday New York Times, no less, saying that it wasn't true, and yet the Trumpists believe it. And the genesis of that comes from the Nazi group Blood Tribe that was marching through Springfield. And they also, not incidentally, are networked with the Azov units in Ukraine. And so we'll see what happens.
And now, thanks to the events of the 2024 election, they literally have a foothold in the White House.
They do indeed. A Nazi foothold. Yeah, and one of the things we're going to talk about as we get into the programs, and you know, we'll see how long we can do this week, but if not next week or whenever, because you've had the death in the family, and I understand that, but we're going to talk about, you know, Trump's supposed, you know, affinity with Vladimir Putin. And that's completely ridiculous. But I think in terms of understanding the barstool fascism that we've got, we're going to take turns reading Mappy from the article Nuremberg on the Hudson. And I'm going to begin the reading, and then I'm going to ask that you pick up after the, because at one point the author, he does a good job, but, you know, talks about, you know, Vladimir Putin and all this stuff, and the whole notion that Putin, I mean, you know, quote, Russiagate, unquote, the quote, special prosecutor, unquote, Robert Mueller, a very special prosecutor indeed. He is the grandnephew of Richard Bissell, and he's married to Ann Cabell Standish, the granddaughter of General Charles P. Cabell. So, I mean, his deep state credentials are most very solid, but it's just absolute drivel, Russiagate. I mean, what they're doing is they're trying to pin American fascism on Russia, and that dog won't hunt. But a very telling article. You'll want to wonder what you have governing the land now. This is it. And there was an article in Cover Punch magazine of November 1st of 2024 by Matthew Stevenson. It's called Nuremberg on the Hudson. And I'm going to read the first part, Monty, and then I'm going to ask you to skip down to we'll skip the part about Putin and so forth. I think I've sent you the edited copy, but this really characterizes what you've got. You know, you want to warn me, well, what's the 12 presidents you can have? This is what you've got. It's barstool fascism. I'll expand on that later. Matthew Stevenson writes, the Trump American blend decided to use Madison Square Garden to stage yet another of its Trump Reich rallies, complete with a sea of red hats, bankrupt Rudy Giuliani taking a break from his criminal trials and liquidating his assets, and a Valium-packed Melania, who, when she greeted her husband on stage, had the blank look of Jodie Foster in Panic Room when confronted by one of her tormentors. The rally made headlines because of the many racist jokes and allusions dished up in the garden. Quote, I don't know if you guys know this, but there's literally a floating island of garbage in the middle of the ocean right now. Yeah, I think it's called Puerto Rico, unquote. Although in the spirit of the buck stopping there, Donald Trump later said to the speaker, quote, I have no idea who he is. Somebody said there was a comedian that joked about Puerto Rico or something, and I have no idea who it was. Never saw him, never heard of him, and don't want to hear of him. But I have no idea, unquote. What, spoken like a true chief executive. Continuing. Otherwise, the rally was simply a replay of the same speakers and speeches that serenaded Trump at the 2020 and 2024 Republican National Conventions, as if no one in Trump world could be bothered to come up with new material. Trump made the same histrionic, self-inflated points he has expressed at every rally in the last year, and he delivered his formal remarks in the same C-spot run monotone he has used to read all of his speeches. But with his endless digressions, quote, she even called for free sex change operations on illegal aliens in detention at taxpayer expense. Think of it, at taxpayer, she's a radical left person from San Francisco. She destroyed the place, but she lied about that, but she also lied about something very important. For years and years, she said she had a job at McDonald's, unquote. Trump's speech lasted almost 2 hours. In all, it was a six-hour affair to announce, quote, vote for Trump on November 5th and put an end to democracy, unquote. The mainstream media highlighted the vileness of the rally language, not just that used by Trump, but the gems offered up by some of his bizarre pitchmen and women who bounced on stage every 10 minutes for the first 4 hours of the spectacle, after which Trump himself picked up the hit parade of insults. For example, Associated Press read its account of the rally in this manner. The event was a surreal spectacle that included former professional wrestler Hulk Hogan, TV psychologist Dr. Phil McGraw, former Fox News host Tucker Carlson, politicians including House Speaker Mike Johnson, and Representatives Byron Bommels and Elise Stefanik, S-T-E-F-A-N-I-K, and an artist who painted a picture of Trump hugging the Empire State Building. The account in the New York Times began this way. Donald J. Trump's closing rally at Madison Square Garden on the second-to-last Sunday before the election was a release of rage at a political and legal system that impeached, indicted, and convicted him, a vivid and at times racist display of the dark energy animating MAGA, the MAGA movement. A comic kicked off the rally by dismissing Puerto Rico as a, quote, floating island of garbage, unquote, then mocked Hispanics for failing to use birth control, Jews as cheap, and Palestinians as rock throwers, and called out a black man in the audience with a reference to watermelon. Another speaker likened Vice President Kamala Harris to a prostitute with, quote, pimp handlers, unquote. A third called her, quote, the Antichrist, unquote. And the former Fox News host Tucker Carlson mocked Ms. Harris, the daughter of an Indian mother and a Jamaican father, with a made-up ethnicity, saying she was vying to become, quote, the first Samoan-Malaysian, low-IQ, former California prosecutor ever to be elected president, unquote. Despite the rage and bitterness of the rally, Nuremberg missing only the columns of light, question mark, Trump and Vance remain ahead in most of the battleground state polls and have a 50% chance of getting elected on November 5th and thereafter implementing their not-so-secret agenda of turning the United States into a white nationalist Christian nation in which it will be made clear that even Hitler, quote, did some good things, unquote. It took me almost 2 days to watch all 6 hours of what felt like a Klan meeting under the big top at Madison Square Garden. Parenthetically, Fred Trump, as we looked at last week, was arrested in that's Trump's father, was arrested at a Klan rally in 1927. Continuing. Sometimes, needing a break from the vitriol, I would read the transcript when I found the speaker to be especially grating. But then I would go back and listen to the offending passages, just to be sure that they were still speaking at a political rally and had not mistakenly drifted off into the tents of a freakish sideshow. The Garden Rally matters at many levels, not only because it was billed as the last occasion before the election, when Donald Trump would summarize his case to be president to the American people. It will also offer him a last chance to evaluate potential members of his cabinet, from the likes of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and former member of Congress Tulsi Gabbard, and I would add a member of the Hare Krishna cult, as is her husband, her parents, and her former congressional staff, and both former Democrats. One more time. The Garden Rally matters at many levels, not only because it was billed as the last occasion before the election when Donald Trump would summarize his case to be president to the American people. It will also offer him a last chance to evaluate potential members of his cabinet, from the likes of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and former member of Congress Tulsi Gabbard, both former Democrats. Overall, Trump is mostly drawn to turncoats. The audition was reduced to one act. The supplicants had to prostrate themselves on the biggest public stage to prove their undying fealty to their lord and master, Donald Trump. Here are some program notes from the footlights. And by the way, we're going to talk about Robert F. Kennedy Jr., brainworm Bobby, later on. The evolution of Robert F. Kennedy from mainstream liberal Democrat to a Trump footman and shill is instructive for the lure that Trump's return to power holds over many aspiring politicians from both parties. Originally, Kennedy's political following came out of his work for environmental and climate justice. Going back more than 20 years, he campaigned for a cleaner Hudson River and against strip mining in Appalachia. Bobby Jr. testified in front of Congress, wrote articles, and even produced a documentary film on the degradations of strip mining called The Last Mountain from 2011. Now, as a wholly owned Trump man, I would imagine he owns a few coal excavators. Come the pandemic, and we're going to talk about this at length in these programs, Kennedy turned into a rabid anti-vaxxer, equating the work of Dr. Anthony Fauci and other doctors with shamanism and voodoo. But because RFK Jr. spoke well, despite suffering from spasmodic dysphonia, perhaps triggered by his years as a heroin addict, people at least gave him a hearing which encouraged him to run for president in 2024 as a third-party candidate, arguing that both major parties were broken. In theory, with the Kennedy brand synonymous with liberalism, President Joe Biden then still in the race and afterward Vice President Kamala Harris had the most to fear from an independent Kennedy candidacy. Except that once he was in the race, albeit with the same chances as Walter Mitty, Bobby Jr.'s positions was similar to those of Donald Trump in that he was pro-Putin, pro-fracking, and in favor of the market sorting out the climate crisis, even though that same market has turned the planet into a suffocating hothouse, to the point that most members of his illustrious Democratic family denounce his presidential campaign as a fraud. In the end, Bobby Jr. suspended his campaign, but he remains on the ballot in several states, in hope of further screwing the Democrats. Had he endorsed Donald Trump and agreed to serve on his transition team and now as a headliner at his rallies, and I would add he also may be very well be shaping public health policy under the Donald. Continuing. At the Garden, trying to excuse his presence at a Trump rally, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. tried to imagine that his famous father and uncle would also by now have become Trumpers. He said, "And I didn't say I didn't leave the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party left me. This is not the party anymore of Martin Luther King, of Robert Kennedy, of John Kennedy. That was a party of peace. It was a party of constitutional rights, of civil rights, of freedom of speech. It was the party that wanted to protect and nurture the middle class. It was the party that stood up to censorship, to surveillance, and stood up to the CIA, the military-industrial complex. And it was the party that wanted to protect public health and women's sports." And, of course, we know what happened with his father and uncle. Continuing, only after Kennedy was safely aboard good ship Trump was it revealed that his dalliance with a New York Magazine reporter involved the receipt of her nude photographs. Even though the exchanges lasted almost a year, Kennedy claimed he was the victim of sexual harassment and threatened to denounce his virtual lover to the police or sue her. All this came from a man who, as his second marriage was failing, kept a diary of his double-digit extramarital sexual conquests with a points system to indicate how well he regarded each conquest. Now, just surreal. Now, Kennedy's role, and by the way, we're going to talk about Kennedy and his campaign and the CIA and all kinds of wonderful things who backed it. Now, Kennedy's role in the campaign is that of a Trump surrogate on political issues. Presumably, Trump doesn't need any help abusing women on his own. And he can dream of serving as Trump's Secretary of Health and Human Services and recommend leeches and bleeding as the most evident cures. I confess that I scrolled through much of the speeches of Hulk Hogan and Dr. Phil. Hulk lost me with his introduction. Quote, "Well, let me tell you something, Trumpomaniacs. Welcome to the house that Hulkamania built. You know something? Usually when I'm in Madison Square Garden, I'm body-slamming giants, I'm winning world heavyweight titles, and I'm cracking people over the heads with steel chairs, and the energy in Madison Square Garden is off the Richter scale. But today, Trumpomaniacs, the energy in here is something like I've never felt. The energy of all these Trumpomaniacs is the most powerful force in the universe, and today this is Donald Trump's house, brother. You know something, Trumpomaniacs? I don't see no stinking Nazis in here." Oh, really? "I don't see no stinking domestic terrorists in here." Oh, really? Well, by the way, those are my additions. "The only thing I see here are a bunch of hardworking men and women that are real Americans, brother." Bear in mind Jonathan Katz's ruminations on January 6th and 1934. Anyway, but if you take Hulk's inference that the phony appeal of professional wrestling speaks to the same attractions of the Donald Trump campaign, Dr. Phil tried to gin up sympathy for Trump voters who have been harassed or canceled or, yes, bullied, unquote, for announcing their choice in the election. He said, quote, "Why am I here? I'll tell you why I'm here. I'm here to talk to and stand up for the people who had declared their support for Donald J. Trump. Well, they got found out, or they want to do it, but they're too intimidated. Because you know what happens when somebody in this country says, hey, I'm going to vote Republican, I'm going to vote Donald J. Trump, unquote. They get canceled, intimidated, marginalized, excluded, or even fired or boycotted. And you know what that means? In short, that adds up to being bullied." Then the author adds, "Sorry, Phil, but the last time I looked, it was the MAGA crowd, some wearing Viking headdresses, that was swinging hockey sticks in the Capitol and relieving themselves on Nancy Pelosi's desk." Skipping down, Carlson next found time to host a two-hour interview on his syndicated television program with Holocaust denier and Nazi sympathizer Beryl Cooper. Bear in mind Hulk Hogan's ruminations. Cooper told Tucker that the, quote, chief villain, unquote, of World War II was Winston Churchill, not Adolf Hitler, and Carlson's cyber alongside the Holocaust, quote, explainer, unquote, with his own white nationalist thinking on the Great Replacement Theory, which has people of color squeezing white Americans out of their own country, a core belief of Trump ralliers. Cooper said, quote, millions of people ended up dead, but that wasn't there, the Nazis' intent, unquote. And then the author adds, maybe it was the Jews themselves who built all these extermination camps, such as Treblinka and Majdanek, and also Yanoska, for which Peter Bezek's father probably worked, or at which.
I see where you're at now. Can I pick up?
Yeah, pick up where it says Tucker's headlining take on his guest, the Nazi-loving Cooper.
My apologies. Tucker's headlining take on his guest, the Nazi-loving Cooper, he wrote, Daryl Cooper may be the best and most honest popular historian in the United States. His latest project is the most forbidden of all, trying to understand World War II. Is it any wonder then that at the Garden, Carlson would riff that Kamala Harris would well be, quote, the first Samoan Malaysian low IQ former California prosecutor to ever be elected president, end quote. If that isn't discouraging, consider that it was Carlson, together with his son Don Jr., who pressed Trump Sr. to select J.D. Vance to run as his vice president.
Not only was J.D. Vance, actually the guy who really was most involved with elevating J.D. Vance was Peter Thiel of Palantir and Facebook, and it was Peter Thiel who financed the lawsuit by Hulk Hogan, whose real name is Terry Bollea. He made a sex tape, and I guess Gawker got a hold of that, and Peter Thiel held a grudge against Gawker because they had outed him as being gay. And so he financed Terry Bollea's, a.k.a. Hulk Hogan's, lawsuit against Gawker, which bankrupted Gawker. So, yeah, Peter Thiel very much involved here. Continue, please, Nopi.
Ridiculous. Continuing, it's hard to imagine two men besides Carlson and Don Jr. who know less about world history, but Vance could be that man. Most of the Trump henchmen and women giving airtime at Madison Square Garden were basically run-of-the-mill crazy. Trump attorney Albina Haba came out dressed for a roller disco and hung her glittering jacket over the lectern as if it were a bar stool. Then she rapped to the crowd about, quote, he the man, end quote, Trump, as if he were a celebrated gang figure, as I suppose he is. Russian and Syrian bot Tulsi Gabbard decided to turn history on its head and said, quote, a vote for Donald Trump is a vote for someone who will defend freedom and every one of our God-given rights that are enshrined in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, end quote. Unless, I suppose, that's the day he's appearing as a dictator and, as he had promised, suspending the Constitution. Someone called David Rem, last name spelling on as R-E-M, seized a mic to say how Trump's father, Fred, paid for his school tuition after his own father had died. He passed himself off as a lifelong friend of Donald Trump until it became clear that he only met a few weeks ago. Rem waved around a crucifix while saying, quote, can you imagine Kamala Harris performing a random, kind, generous act like that? Never. Never, ever. In fact, she is the devil. Whoever screamed that out, she is the Antichrist. At her rally last week, she said that Jesus Christ followers are not welcome at my rally. You should go down the block to President Trump's rally. Let me say this, and maybe I'm speaking for the president, and I shouldn't, but I think that President Trump loves Jesus, followers at his rally. Reading again. But I think President Trump loves Jesus followers at his rally. And I think that President Trump, in what he has expressed, knows that Jesus Christ is king. End quote.
And then in what he has experienced, if there's anybody, and one of the many mind-boggling things, forgive me, Bobby, for butting in, one of the many mind-boggling things about this whole spectacle is watching the evangelical Christians sidling up to a guy who is at the very living refutation of everything that has been meant by Christianity. It is quite remarkable. Please continue.
I don't know if it would be appropriate to interrupt the entire broadcast, but as somebody that was brought up as an evangelical Christian, one of my favorite quotes is from the book of Matthew, from the King James Version of the Bible, and it states just the following, if I might quote it. Book of Matthew, chapter 7, and this is, of course, verses 15 and 16 and 17, quote, "Beware of false prophets, which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are raving wolves. Ye shall know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistle? Even so, every great tree bringeth forth good fruit, but a corrupt tree bringeth forth evil fruit." And then it says right here, skipping down, "Not everyone that say to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter into the kingdom of heaven. But many will say on the day of revelation, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in thy name? And in thy name have cast out devils and done many wonderful works. And I shall profess to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, ye worker of iniquity." So, but I believe that encapsulates literally the evangelical Christian vote for Donald Trump. They call themselves followers of Christ, but Trump literally is the antithesis for everything that is peace, love, and joy. But continuing with the article here, if I may.
Yes, then there was a real estate promoter, Grant Cardone. Go ahead.
Right, right. Grant Cardone. There was a real estate promoter, Grant Cardone, who said in equally manic tones, "Ladies and gentlemen, Kamala Harris is the least qualified candidate to ever run for any political office in American history. She makes her boss look competent. She's a fake. I'm not here to invalidate her. She's a fake, a fraud. She's a pretender. Her grammar has never been a strong suit of the Trump crowd. Her and her pimp handlers will destroy our country. They will. They've already crippled the dollar, manufactured inflation, imported a virus, censor your voices, funded transgender surgeries, and make empty promises to the middle class for 50 years," end quote. Presumably, the ventriloquist Trump would later say of his colleague and talking dummy, Cardone, who called Kamala Harris a prostitute, quote, "I have no idea who he is," end quote. On a personal note, he is in fact a living personification of Sergeant Schultz. I know nothing. I see nothing.
he knows, but in many ways he is Sergeant Schultz, who is carrying around, almost like in the Harry Potter movies, the spirit of Abel Skorzeny and his ilk. You know, I mean,
right.
There is something much larger. I mean, Trump himself is just a front, and I would not be surprised if he gets discarded at some point during the next 4 years.
Right,
we'll talk about
right.
that. But this is what you have now as a president, people, and I hope you are happy for you. Mommy, I'm in my 46th year on the air. I've been warning about fascism coming to America. Now even former Chief of Staff General Mark Milley is warning about it. And he, by the way, just took a position as a consultant earlier this year to J.P.
Right.
Morgan Chase. So,
that's right.
What the guy? Anyway, continuing. Go ahead, Marty. By far the eeriest remark.
Right, right. By far the eeriest remarks at Madison Square Garden came from the former White House aide and concierge, Stephen Miller, the Dr. Evil of a Trump restoration. With his head shaven, wearing a tight suit, which seemed to have been made for a hitman, cut to it, and seemingly the kind of person capable of having long conversations with himself, the wound-up Miller said, quote, "Oh, Lord. In 9 days, your rescue is coming. In 9 days, your salvation is at hand. In 9 days, Donald J. Trump is going to go back to the White House. We stand here today at a crossroads in the history of this nation, in the history of our civilization. There is a choice between betrayal and renewal," between self-destruction and salvation, between the failure of America or the triumph of America. I want you to think for a minute about the decades of abuse that have been heaped upon the good people of this nation, their jobs looted or stolen from them and shipped to Mexico, Asia, and foreign countries, the lives of their loved ones ripped away from them by illegal aliens, criminal gangs and thugs who don't belong in this country, a political system that punishes hardworking citizens, oppresses them at every turn, takes away the right to free speech, the right to political expression, the right to fundamental safety in their own country. Who's going to stand up for our daughters? Who's going to stand up for the girls of America, the women of America, the families of America? Who's going to stand up and say the cartels are gone, the criminal migrants are gone, the gangs are gone? America is for Americans and Americans only. One man, and that man, ladies and gentlemen, the man that took the bullet for you. He took a bullet for democracy, and we're all asking in return. All we are asking in return is for 9 days, nine short, precious days, you have to vote, vote, vote. Vote for freedom. Vote for liberty. Vote for sovereignty. Vote for your children. Vote for your families. Vote for the right of free speech, the right to the Second Amendment. End quote. Clearly, to Stephen Miller, Trump is a cross between Jesus and another misunderstood white supremacist, Adolf Hitler. 4 hours into the tedious autoerotic Vegas showdown, Melania Trump was called to the stage to introduce her husband so that in turn he could speak for another 2 hours. Melania uses fashion to express her rages. Remember her "I really don't care, do you" jacket that she wore to a migrant children detention center? And here she was wearing below the knee zebra print jacket as if maybe she was an endangered species.
Mommy, let me just briefly interrupt that. I've been opposed in the past. "I really don't care, do you?" That's a quote from Mussolini. Okay, so that's where that comes from. Go ahead.
Right, and I should note that's the same Mussolini that ran over a little girl in his vehicle and said, "Oh, well, that's the march of fascism, that's the march of progress, it stops for nobody." Continuing, though, seemingly her message to a porn star-loving husband might have preferred something with a little more décolletage, as was "really don't care, do you?"
The quote, what he's saying is that Melania should have shown more of her boobs. Go ahead. I should say bosom. I don't think that's one of the seven words, but that's what he's implying there. Continue, Marty.
Right. One way to interpret the entire Madison Square Garden Trump follies was that it was an effort by Donald to appear on stage with his wife and force her into a public reconciliation, at least something long enough to be spliced into a 30-second TV spot to air the night before Election Day. No doubt, in exchange for a six-figure appearance fee, Melania showed up at the Garden, but her gloom facial expression was that of a hostage who might well have used her lipstick to write "Help me" on the palms of her hands. She never mentioned Trump by name, nor did she speak of any of his wonderful qualities. Instead, she talked dispectively about New York City, ending by saying, quote, "Let's seize this moment and create a country for tomorrow, the future that we deserve," end quote. Such a sentence could be used on just about any occasion, including if she planned to murder him backstage. From a polite distance, they look like a couple in a waiting room of a marriage therapist. Trump leaned in to kiss his wife, and all she offered him was a turn of both cheeks, the way Europeans greet strangers in a formal setting. Melania has rarely been on the political stage since a court in New York convicted her husband of sexual abuse against E. Jean Carroll and fined Trump $83.3 million for defaming Miss Carroll over several years by denying publicly that he had violated her. And what did Trump say of Miss Carroll that increased the damages to her $83.3 million? He said, quote, "Totally lying. I don't know anything about her. I know nothing about this woman. I know nothing about her," end quote.
Yes, indeed. That's what you have in the White House here. And we're going to be talking in other shows we're about to record about not only Bobby Jr. and his campaign and his views and what's going on with COVID, which is truly remarkable. We're going to turn that, we're going to talk about that. And the Trump's, quote, pro-Putin philosophies. I mean, it's wild, but, you know.
The name of the game is fascism.
It is, and the bearing in mind what Dr. Johnson said, those who make beasts of themselves escape the pain of being human. There's certainly, yes, I mean, workers in America, the middle class has been screwed, but it's the very people behind Trump, the oligarchs that have done the screwing, and instead others are being scapegoated for it. And then I'm going to use very strong language as we wind this up, the bridge to our next program. But what you are seeing here, what you now have, is what I call barstool fascism. It's the guy who's sitting on a Saturday night, maybe 9, 10 o'clock, and he's getting liquored up, and he's starting to feel heady, and he talks to the guy sitting on the bar stool next to him. And I'm going to use very strong language here. But he said, you know what? I'm tired of all these effing niggas, and I'm tired of, you know, the beamers and the faggots and the Jews and all these liberals who are letting all these people in. And there are 50 million Mexicans waiting to come into the country at our southern border, you know. And the guy in Washington said, yeah, you know, I agree with you. And I'm tired of these effing niggas, too. You know, but we got one running for the president, the Democrat, you know, Kamala Harris, man. And they want to replace us. And we got all these Mexicans and Haitians in Springfield, Ohio. And they're poisoning our country. We got to do something about it. And the other guy says, yeah, you know, have you heard this guy, Donald Trump? Yeah, you know, I mean, he says the kind of things I say. And the guy says, yeah, that's right. I like the guy. And the guy says, I like him, too. He talks my language. And the other guy says, yeah, he talks our language. I'm going to vote for him. Yeah, that's it. That's barstool fascism. That's what you have. And forgive me for using strong language, but hell, if that seems strong, you just wait till the reality comes home and wait till all these people.
Just you wait the next 20 to 30 weeks in this country. Just you wait.
And the inflation alone from all the tariffs he's going to slap on these goods. And you've got Elon Musk, the wealthiest man on the planet, the guy who literally has more money than many countries. He's scheduled to become, he's on track to become the world's first trillionaire. And he's going to be helping to slash money on the budget. And he's even said, you know, we're going to have a rough ride. It's going to be really painful for people in this country. Yeah, but not for him, not for the richest guy in the world. It won't be painful for him. And that is the essence of barstool fascism. When you see what's coming, you ain't going to like it. And when you're explaining to your great-grandchildren or grandchildren why they're living in a rusted-out Chevy sport van, please get the 64-gigabyte flash drive. It's going to have, it has all of my life's work on it, plus a mini library of old anti-fascist books, all of the conversations with Monty Pibate, and perhaps going through the, certainly the end of this year, maybe in the early next year. But it will be on a get your order placed. If you have problems with the flash drive, contact KOPAC manager, contact the manager of the station. Nothing I can do about it, but please get that flash drive. Neither Monty nor myself gets any money from this. And we're going to continue with other programs. And, you know, maybe this will sound sort of fatuous, Monty, but, you know, I've been doing this for 46 years, and now we've got a rapper-based Smedley Butler. You, I mean, like Smedley Butler, you are a combat veteran. You've seen combat in America's wars of empire. And you have paid
money. And very much as Smedley Butler, and that's a very, very, very humbling thing to say. Thank you for saying that. But very much as Smedley Butler, I saw up close and personal who was profiting off of those wars as they were happening. You know, so, yep. I mean, what can I say? You know, unlike 20 plus years in the Mideast have done nothing but send back the best and brightest in flag-draped coffins. So,
and you described one experience, so we're going to wrap it up with this. But when you were in Afghanistan and you were being shelled by the Taliban, you ducked under a Humvee for cover, and a 120-millimeter mortar round, the equivalent of the round from the main gun of an Abrams tank, landed right in front of you, collapsed the Humvee on you. You're now 100% disabled, and unlike Donald Trump,
you've
literally shed your blood for this country. And this concludes For the Record program number 1357, Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 31. This is being recorded on November 9th of the year 2024. I'm Dave Emery for Monty. Thanks for listening.